Hey friends, I'm Jenny Meyer, and you're listening to the Rooted Truth Podcast, where we look at the world through a biblical lens. We talk about real life, biblical truth, and how to walk with Jesus through it all. Be sure to follow me on social at Jenny Meyer and at The Rooted Truth. Also, be sure to subscribe to the members-only, all-exclusive episodes on the Rooted Truth Podcast by going to www.therootedtruth.com. Now let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited today to have with me a guest who's going to go into the history of premillennial dispensationalism. His name is Jeremy Sladen. Jeremy is the founder of J Slay USA platform, where he explores truth, exposes deception, and inspires courage through bold interviews and Bible studies. Follow his work at handle J Slay USA on Rumble, Instagram, and Substack. He's also the founder and head coach of Warrior Mind, Body, and Soul, a program for Christian men to get their mojo back through physical fitness and community. Not only is he a content creator and founder of J Slay USA, he is a husband and father to two boys. He is a former addict now living with freedom, as well as a certified personal trainer, Division I college athlete, and seven-year pro ball player in the Phillies organization. Help me welcome Jeremy Sladen. So welcome, Jeremy. I am really, really excited to chat today. Lori and I were on your podcast a couple of weeks ago about the 70th week of Daniel, but I wanted to have you come on. I've read some of your stuff about dispensationalism and just really digging into the history. And I thought it would be great for the listeners to just hear some of this history of where this came from. But before we get started, do you want to kind of introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit of what got you into this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great to be on your show. And it's really cool the way social media works. Yeah. I had written my article and somebody on my Instagram had read it that communicates often on Instagram with me. And they said, hey, have you heard of The Rooted Truth? Because they're going over the exact same thing that you are, bringing up some of the same points. So He sent me one of your links, and it was the one, it was one that you touched on, the 70 weeks in Daniel. Yeah. I downloaded you guys' PDF, phenomenal job on that. Sent that to my mom and dad, and they usually don't really respond to that stuff. I mean, They're definitely into it, but they're in that, premillennial dispensational frame of mind. And my mom wrote back, wow, exclamation point. And then you even recommended a book at the bottom of that PDF. Yep. I saw that book laying on her kitchen counter the next day.
Oh, that's so funny. That's awesome.
So what you're doing makes a difference. And I'm glad to be on with you. To introduce myself, I, Tennessean, grew up here in Tennessee, loved baseball, loved the Lord, had a Christian family, definitely in the whole, in terms of end times and eschatology, which we're going to get into some of that. I was in the Left Behind movement, thinking how could Kirk Cameron and who are the author, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, they could not possibly be wrong. Right. And I would go to the conferences and all that. And all the while a busy kid. I was very active in sports, social life, all the normal things. So you just kind of, it seemed pretty well researched, all those things. And they're doing entire, youth conferences about it that I was going to. So I thought, well, it's just not going to be wrong. Plus look at the rest of the, I thought America, we got it figured out too. The rest of the world's crazy and kind of evil and dark. So I'm just not going to question it too deeply. Yeah. And, ended up going to Georgia Tech to play baseball. And then from that had a career with the Phillies in the minor leagues, Philadelphia Phillies, until I was 30 years old. Wow. And, without going into too much detail on it, when you leave something like that, you kind of have a loss of identity because you've done it your whole life. Everybody knows you as an athlete and a ball player. And so there were some addictions I'd been nursing along the way with the nightlife and the drinking and all this stuff I'd allowed myself to get into. And I made some bad choices right when sports ended for me. I'm in a big city. My body was broken down. I was in constant pain. My identity in Christ was not nearly as strong as it should have been. And rather than connect with people that could have helped me find that firm foundation, again, and get me back on my feet, I kind of isolated. And that just led into some more bad decisions, to be honest. And that's not the purpose of this show, but I wanted to share that because I think being able to take a look at where we're at honestly and say, this is legitimately, like, the decisions I'm making every day are not they're sinful. They're wrong. Yeah. And I had to own that. And then I looked around at the world as I was getting healthy, getting honest. I became 100% honest with my wife about all the stuff that was going on. And through a process of about a year, found great health and a great relationship with the Lord again. And I mean, it's not all sunshine and roses, but man, it's way better than it was. And then I looked around at the world, and by this time it's 2018, 2019, getting toward the COVID era. And I saw all this deception going on. And I was like, you know, what the whole world needs is a good dose of taking a hard look in the mirror and getting honest about the stuff that's going on. And here's the thing about that. It's really tough to take that look and to honestly acknowledge the problems in your own life, much less, you know, an entire country or the world, right? So not that I have all the answers on those things, but I did think we're allowing ourselves to be deceived because it's just easier, right? So more years pass. We get past COVID and all this. And I felt strongly that God was calling me into seek truth and speak truth beyond what I was doing, which was being a government contractor, selling roofs to the government. And I kind of realized, you know, even the money I'm making from these roofing jobs is coming from tax dollars supporting things that I don't support at all. And I understand you've got to make a living, right? So, but I just felt strongly I need to get out of that and get into this truth-telling environment. Well, I launched J Slay USA. All your listeners can go to J Slay USA on Rumble or Substack. Now, Instagram, I'm on all the time. That's where I've got my biggest following. I have a lot of fun on that. But Substack's where I write my more long-form content, and that's where some of the articles that we're going to discuss today are on. And then Rumble's where I put out the visual version of that. Well, as a, you know, leading to that point where I was kind of creating my own stuff, I was having guests come on. I would have missionaries, authors, Christian authors, many times, pastors, heads of entire organizations. And, you know, because of all the, I mean, this was like a year into COVID, all the stuff with BLM was going on all over the country. So there were a lot of fascinating guests giving me a Christian perspective of these events. And because of all these events, we're not just, you know, localized to a state or a country, they were global in nature. I would ask them, where are we at on the prophetic timeline? Just assuming that these guys were going to hold fast to that kind of left behind premillennial dispensationalism. And that's a big word, but we can get into to the definition in a minute. And, they kind of would give me these soft answers, or they wouldn't really answer the question. And I kind of gave them a pass on it, because I was like, well, maybe there's a reason they didn't answer. After the show, I would say, like, hey, why didn't you really answer that question? Or where do you really stand on this issue on where we're at? And they would say many times, not every time, but many times, you know, as long as you're not recording, I'll tell you, I can't really get into this on the air, because my mission board or my publisher or whoever, they really wouldn't like this, or it would cause a stir. But but I used to hold to premillennial dispensationalism. And after researching it more thoroughly on my own, I realized a few things. It's only a couple hundred years old at the most. And it's got some real problems with it biblically. And it really comes back to these two, and they would always give me the name, John Nelson Darby and Cyrus Schofield, C.I. Schofield. These were new names to me. I didn't know who these characters were. And it bothered me because I had considered other viewpoints. I mean, at that point in my life, I'd heard of postmillennialism, amillennialism, the different versions of, you know, premillennial dispensationalism. But I'd never really done a deep dive on my own. So I began to do that deep dive. I realized, wow, this entire end times theology is pretty new. Now, I don't think that those guys nailed it on where it actually started. And it started a process for me of discovery. That's why I wrote that first article. Because I came upon some pretty amazing facts that opened my eyes and led me into taking, again, an honest look at how this came about and being willing to follow the truth where its conclusions lead, regardless of if I like it or not.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it when you're studying and looking into this stuff. So Thank you for that background.
I hope I didn't talk too long, Jenny.
No. I love it when guests talk because I just like soak it up too. And I learned so much when I talk to people. I'm sure you're the same way when you have people on and you're just like, wow. And so I'm really excited to get into this topic because, I mean, like, you know, we at The Rooted Truth, Lori and I have been studying this. We have been doing a lot of content, mostly podcasts. We just wrote a Revelation commentary. We have a Daniel commentary, literally probably the last 18 months of really digging in. And for me, it really started with, where did this 7-year tribulation idea come from? Because I was struggling internally with that idea. And I know we talked about this on your show, but, you know, being raised with this left behind mentality, and when the Holy Spirit stirs something inside you to question it, you need to follow that. And so I appreciate your research around this too, and really digging into, okay, where did this come from? Not necessarily the approach that I took with they took Daniel 9 out of context and threw in an antichrist, threw in the 70th week of Daniel with a 7-year tribulation, but of like, where did it start? You know, who out there started this? And so that's what I want to get into today. And I think we'll probably do like a 10,000 foot view of just all of this and really just have a conversation about it. And I know that people are going to find this fascinating because I know I do. So I guess let's start out with, in a nutshell, what is dispensational premillennialism? Or even if you just want to start out with like dispensationalism, because that's what leads into the eschatology of it.
Sure. Absolutely. And this one, I do have a definition pulled up for. So if it sounds like I'm reading, it's because I am, but it's the best way to do it. So dispensationalism is a man-made system of dividing the Bible, typically consisting of 7 different stages where God dispenses. That's where the word comes from. He's dispensing his grace and knowledge differently to human beings throughout history. Now, what it does is this: it allows Bible scholars to place passages of scripture into the dispensations that they believe either do or don't apply to various peoples in time. And the reason why that's interesting, you'll hear people that have been on the journey we've been on call it hopscotch theology, where they can take a verse from Daniel, take a verse from Revelation, take a verse from Thessalonians, stack those together and say, do you see the order? Does it fit? And the truth is, yes, people are smart enough. They can make things kind of chronologically work out. You can create a system. That's why they call it a system of eschatology, dispensational premillennialism. And the truth is, this is my truth, and I hate that word, but I think a lot of the listeners would agree. It's not something, when you really get honest about it, if you understand the left behind theology, the rapture, the 7-year tribulation, the return of Christ beyond that, the 1,000-year millennial reign, the Zionism that most conservative Christian churches are holding to right now, you wouldn't come up with it on just a basic, honest reading of scripture without being trained and taught either like I was through youth groups constantly. We talked about it through the 80s and 90s and with pop culture. And I mean, the truth is, a lot of it for me came from left behind books, a lot more than it came from me sitting down at 10 years old to 15 years old when I was really forming these thoughts. It did not come from me reading the books of Daniel or Thessalonians or Revelation and saying, wow, this is what I came up with. It doesn't, and that's why a guy like John Nelson Darby, who we'll get into, was able to say, honestly, he said, this is a new teaching. This teaching is like new wine. And then he went so far in one of his personal letters to say, we've got to be very cautious in disseminating this because it scares people. It's brand new. And he was pretty prideful about it too. He said, like, God has revealed these new things to the brethren, which was really him. I mean, he owned these Plymouth brethren, and he wasn't the founder of that group of men, but he definitely was the hard charging leader as soon as they accepted him into their ranks. So long definition there, but that's kind of the basics.
Yeah. And so I like that you laid that out. I do want to preface this, that if you're listening to this podcast and you have not listened to the one previous to this, the episode right before this one on the main podcast, Rooted Truth. Go listen to that, because what I did to kind of set the stage for this upcoming episode was laid out, here are the main views of Revelation, the main views of end times. So I went over just real briefly each one: the dispensational premillennialism, historic premillennialism, postmillennialism, amillennialism, and then breaking that down with futurism, historicism, preterism, you know, all of these things. And so I really encourage you to go listen to that so that some of these terms that we're speaking on this episode make sense. And you can kind of put the pieces together of like what section of that, this is one view of the end times. So you talked a little bit about John Nelson Darby. A lot of people give him the credit that, hey, he came up with this view, you know, in the 1800s. What happened before that? Because I really enjoyed your research of what came before him. So if you want to dive into that.
Well, there's a lot there. So, you know, help guide me into not going too deep where I don't need to and all that. But before I do, I want to say this. I gave a definition right there for dispensationalism, that kind of hopscotch way of putting things together. The core components of it that make up truly what premillennial dispensationalism is, there's two big things. And one is the premillennial rapture. So a rapture prior to a tribulation, prior to a millennial reign, you've got a rapture of the saints. The other is God's separate program or plan theologically for ethnic Israel as apart from the church. That one, actually, the deeper that you dig into John Nelson Darby's life or Manuel Lacunza, the Jesuit priest who we're going to get into, that was the biggie to them. They cared more about that, the Jewish state, a Jewish renaissance in Palestine, than they even did about the rapture. It's almost as if the more I read on this, everything else in premillennial dispensationalism was really crafted for that purpose. And you have to ask yourself, why? And, you know, and I'm still learning about it. I honestly am. And the last article that I did, I get more into it, and I think it's going to continue. But so, all right, 10,000 foot level prior to John Nelson Darby. Okay. So you had the Protestant Reformation going on at the time. So the Catholic Church was the big boy in town. You know, when it came to global Christianity, people would think of the Pope and the Vatican, and they were beholden to that in a big way, although there were other sects around the world. But the Protestants came along and they were going to stop being bullied, right? Martin Luther, William Tyndale, many of the others, a lot of people know about the 95 Theses. And they basically said, stop bullying us. No more. No, we want to have the English language of the Bible. We want to get back to a scriptural understanding of it as it reads and not be dictated to by a professional Christian, being the priest or the Pope, telling us what we have to believe. And, you know, there were all these just crazy things that they were doing, like selling indulgences to help your dead relatives spend less time in purgatory or hell. And Martin Luther saw through all of that, and he said, no more. And this was really appealing to the German people, to people all over Europe. And for that reason, the Catholic Church began to hemorrhage their power and their influence. And of course, any, you know, powerful entity that begins losing people and losing influence is going to be angry. So the Protestant Reformation became enemy number one. Mm-hmm. Well, right after that, you've got the formation of the Jesuit order, which these were kind of like the militant arm of the Catholic Church. And when they had the Council of Trent. So they had this Council of Trent, which they did a lot at this council, but one of the things was, how are we going to counter this Reformation? And that's when the Pope validated, he'd done it right before, but he validated these Jesuits, which was these group of mostly crypto Jews. If you get into that, it's very interesting. And the modern day Jesuit order tries to deny this. They don't deny that there were crypto Jews in it, but they try to say it was never really fashioned around crypto Jews. And they said, and pretty quickly, crypto Jews stopped joining. Now, what a crypto Jew was this goes before the Reformation. Even the Catholic Church was enforcing their faith on anybody, you know, whether they were another religion or a budding Protestant or whatever. They'd say, no, we're going to kill you or expel you out of the country if you don't convert to straight up Catholicism, which is not exactly what Jesus Christ and the Gospels, I don't think that was the style that he was going for. And so many of the Jewish people did not want to leave. Mm-hmm. And so they would begrudgingly say, sure, we'll convert. And so outwardly they would do all the, you know, they'd pray the prayers, they would do all the things, but inwardly their heart held to two things, their Jewish identity and a desire for revenge. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if the original founder of the Jesuit order was Ignatius of Loyola. He might have been a crypto Jew himself because his parents were of a Jewish, or one of his parents were of a Jewish lineage. But we do know that he definitely admired the Jewish people, and that four of the seven original members were crypto Jews. Hmm. All right. So that matters in the sense of, if you go way down the line, where did this political Zionism come from? Why is there an infiltration into Catholic doctrines, which we're going to get into, and then eventually Protestant doctrines, to begin to have their own version of a replacement theology where Israel is going to replace the church? Yeah. And again, we'll get back into that. Yeah. So, because I've been trying to piece this together on why is there such a strong Jewish influence in all of this? And as I go, go ahead.
So question though, do the crypto Jews have any connection to the Khazarian Jews? And that, I don't know if you're familiar with just that understanding. This was probably 500 years prior to the Jesuit order, where the Khazarians were forced by the Russian king, like, hey, you need to convert to either Judaism, yeah, Christianity, or Catholicism. And so it was like this false Judaism that they chose, but they were still worshiping Baal. So is there any connection?
Yeah, I would say it's absolutely going to be a mix.
Okay.
No, because you've got the Khazarian, you know, they converted because it was politically expedient for them to do so. They were not, and they never truly adopted Torah reading Judaism, just like you said. Yep. But you've got Jews all over. I mean, like this Manuel Lacunza, who we're going to get to, his family was living in Chile. You know, is it Chile or Chile? How should I say it?
I say Chile. I don't know. I say Chile.
I always think, like, am I going to sound like a dumb Southerner? Like I kind of am, but
no, I think that's, I pronounce things so wrong every time. So my audience is totally used to it. So okay, you're good.
Good deal. Yeah. Don't judge me too harshly if it's Chile, you know, anyhow. He would have been a crypto Jew. It was so hard to find this, but I found that Lacunza was a name of a crypto Jewish family originally from Spain. They went to Chile, all this. Wow. But to answer your question, it's going to be a mix. You're going to have Sephardic Jews in there that are legitimately, you know, of some kind of Jewish bloodline. And any time that you're doing something like enforcing your religion on someone, which is what the Catholics were doing.
Yep.
You're going to have all types of people that are just trying to protect themselves, saying, yeah, you know, I'll be Catholic too, because I have to be. Yeah. I'm not one that would say, oh, you know, absolutely, they were all Khazarian, because it was happening all over Europe. So it's going to be a big mix.
Okay. That makes sense. So then we have like 1500s, we have this Protestant Reformation, we have this Jesuit order established. And then, after that, within the Jesuits, the next 150 years?
Well, let's get into
one
of the things I should have said. The Protestant theology of the time was that they were living in a millennium. They were living and they said during this, you know, maybe that's the wrong word, but they believed that they were in an ongoing end times scenario, and that the Pope was the beast of Revelation, and that the Vatican was the beast system, or the Antichrist system. Yep. And obviously that was, you know, terrible for the Catholic Church. They didn't want people saying that. So there were two ways that they wanted to root that out. One was through violence, torture, all of that, which is called the, I always forget the name of it, the Inquisition.
Okay.
Yeah, the Inquisition going on. But the Jesuits were really sharp, and they were commissioned to infiltrate Protestant theology. So that's why, you know, I'm getting back to the Catholic intelligentsia. You had these three or more Jesuit priests. They were all Jesuits. Ribera, and I'm going to forget the names, but leading up to Lacunza, there were two before him. And they were putting together more clearly than ever before those core components I mentioned. Political Zionism and this new nation state of Israel that was going to come about as an end times thing to push everything forward, and also this idea of the rapture. And the last Jesuit priest of those three was Manuel Lacunza. And interestingly enough, on his book, which was The Coming of Messiah in Glory and Majesty, he claimed his authorship as Rabbi Juan Yosefat Ben Ezra, a converted Jew. And man, this is a lot to remember.
No, I know. So essentially, he wrote a book called The Coming of Messiah in Glory and Majesty, but with a different name. So basically, not saying that it was him, this Jesuit.
Yeah,
right?
And for good reason, because the Protestants would have had in no way had anything to do with taking advisement from Catholics.
Wow.
Just period. And especially a Jesuit priest, because the Jesuit order, again, were known as the more militant arm of Catholicism. Well, you had this this one Scottish Reformed minister named Edward Irving, and he already had a soft spot for Jewish people. He was part of this council for converting Jews, and I forget the name of it, but it was called like the Society for Jewish Conversion, something along those lines, right in London. So there was already a soft spot there. Mm. He was already kind of like a big prophecy guy. His mind was pretty fixated on prophecy. And he discovers this book. It had been printed before, but it had never been printed in English. He only spoke broken Spanish at the time. And the book was written in Spanish in terms of the one that he found. He learned Spanish so that he could actually publish his own version. Not, I shouldn't say version. He had a long, like 77 page preface to it that he wrote. And then he had it published in London. He fell in love with the book. And it really advanced his ideas on dispensationalism, on Zionism, and on the rapture. And he was very popular. He was a part of these prophecy conferences called the Albury Prophetic Conferences. And that is where Darby and he, I believe, started to rub elbows. It's very hard to find Darby ever mention Irving, but he does a couple of times in his private letters. Mm-hmm. That's actually hard to find, but you can find it. So Edward Irving is popularizing these new doctrines, not even knowing for a long time. He didn't even know that it was actually a Manuel Lacunza, the Jesuit priest that had done these ideas. So he's popularizing it. And I'll stop there because I don't want to jump too far ahead.
Yeah, no. So this is like, as far as timeline goes, this is what, mid to late 1700s. Then we're getting into early 1800s when Darby and Irving. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so you got late 1800s for Lacunza. He wrote the book in 1790 was when he actually like finished it.
Okay.
It doesn't really get discovered at all until like the year 1800. Then there's like these, you know, people that are secretly publishing it, because the Catholic Church actually, for some, and I've got to look more into this, the Catholic Church was saying no to it. Like, we're not going to officially acknowledge or publish this. Mm-hmm. Cause they had, and I think it was more about Lacunza himself. They had a problem with.
Okay.
But Irving discovered it in 1826, had it published in 1827. And then Darby and he really, you know, when I say come together, I mean, begin to share ideas at these prophetic conferences. Darby really takes off in the 1830s.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought as far as timeline. The 1800s were so crazy with how many things like came out, like Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, all in the 1800s. Like, I think
that's right. And, you know, we think that our information is controlled today, but we still, I mean, even though there's a lot of censorship, and I think the global powers that be are trying to retake control in a major way. But back then, if it wasn't coming from the church or from some kind of correspondence from family, you know, it was just, you had these power brokers, whether it be the Pope or the Church of England or the monarchies of the day. And what they said was kind of gospel truth. I mean, unless you were there for an event, they could tell you anything and you kind of had to believe it for the most part, which was what Martin Luther and others were trying to push back against. So it's no surprise that this was known as the era of cults. And I want to read real quick, because when information is so controlled and there's just a few powerful figures saying this is the truth, you just kind of believe it because you many times trust these people. But the 18th and 19th century saw a dramatic movement away from the general optimism of the Great Awakening. So I'll stop there for a second. There was more of a post-millennial view of biblical prophecy going on prior to this time. But you had a sustained period of turmoil on both sides of the Atlantic. There was the American War of Independence, the French Revolution, and the Napoleonic Wars. So all across the Christian world, you've got all this unrest, and there was a very confusing effect on the dominant millennial eschatology of the established Reformed churches. And also these churches, not only the Catholic Church, but at this point, the Reformed churches were becoming stale and corrupt. And that's what Darby saw. That's what Irving had a problem with. And rightly so. Part of the reason these men were as popular as they were is because they were correctly calling out corruption. But alongside of that were there were these belief systems they were, you know, also infecting the people with that were wrong. So it was kind of like there was a good and the bad going on at the same time. And this in turn, because you mentioned 1800s, just that those few decades there, you had the Irvingites of the 1820s, which they're still around. They're very small, but they're still around.
Wow.
Mormonism was birthed in 1830. The Darbyites, which we know as the Plymouth Brethren, and also you could call the Darbyites of today globally those who have a premillennial dispensationalism. So they're not straight up Plymouth Brethren, they have taken that one aspect of their eschatology. That was the 1830s. Seventh-day Adventism, 1840. The Jehovah's Witnesses, they didn't come around until 1880, but they had a connection with Darby and those guys going way back. So there was, I just wanted to mention that because you mentioned 1800s. There was a lot going on at that time.
Wow. I mean, I think the enemy was rampant in the 1800s. He still is today. Like, let's be real, but like, that's just amazing.
I think it's the enemy a lot of times takes something bad, you know, and it's like when that's run its course and there's some good guys coming. Because if you read the personal letters of John Darby or Edward Irving or even Manuel Lacunza, the priest, I honestly, my heart kind of goes out to them because you can see where they started. And that these men, I think, even though Darby has some stuff that's almost too weird to overcome, but when it comes to Irving and it comes to even Manuel Lacunza, I'm thinking, gosh, these guys were suffering for their faith. And I think that they truly believed in Christ and they were wanting to spread the gospel. But I think that they were rightly and they were rightly calling out corruption and some bad stuff. And I think when the enemy sees that, he's like, okay, how can I corrupt this before they get too far down the road? So it's up for, you know, we're in a lucky spot because now we can do our own research and we've got the internet. And it's the onus is on individual people to use discernment, be in prayer, and to actually take the time to do some research because it's not 1830 anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So then, okay. So we have 1830, Darby and Irving kind of meet together at, was it a conference? Was that what it was?
Yes. So they were linked together by a common thread. There was a woman named, now her name's slipping my mind.
Is it Powers Court?
Yes. The Lady Powers Court. So she was a wealthy socialite, much like Irving. She had a strong fixation on prophecy. And she attended the first group of conferences called the Albury Conferences.
Okay.
That was the ones where Irving really came to the forefront. And she loved those. And she thought, what, this is so amazing. And these ideas are so fresh that I want to have my own group of conferences. So she had the Powers Court conferences at her mansion, which if you go to my article, which again, Substack, J. Slay USA, I've got pictures of a lot of this stuff to kind of walk you through it. And what an amazing like mansion that she owned where they held these conferences. that's where she was friends with Irving. Irving actually came during those Power Court conferences and stayed in that mansion for a week while they went on. She was friends with Darby as well. So even though Darby only mentions Irving like once or twice ever in anything he writes, he mentions the Power Court conferences a lot. Okay. So we know he was there. We know that Irving was there. And this is when dispensationalism really grew legs in terms of the core components, political Zionism and even religious Zionism. And also this idea of the rapture. And I can, whenever you're ready, I can go into why the rapture was important for Zionism. Cause I used to think, well, those are separate things, but they both fit in with the Bible. But there's actually a very calculated, sophisticated reason that they work together.
Yeah. Why don't we do that? And then after that, if you want to give us just a quick brief, like some of the stuff that Darby was involved in and then his connection to Schofield, because that's where it kind of gets to us today. But yeah, I'm really curious to hear that connection.
Yeah. So what the rapture allows for is first of all, say this, Darby and Irving both really kind of love the Jewish people almost more than they love their own people once they bought onto this theology. And they said that the church is more of just a parenthesis in God's dispensation for his real people, which are the Jewish people. And I'm not just saying that. I mean, I've been shocked at some of the things I've read from Darby, where he's like, you know, the church, yes, we have a heavenly home. We're going to be with Jesus. It's wonderful. But his real plan is all about the Jews. So people, you know, claim that I'm a, you know, replacement theologian, yeah. Or that I believe in replacement theology. And they try to use that as a way to shut me up or to say like, this is heretical. But the truth is, Darby was a replacement theologist too, but he just believed that Israel was going to take back its seat and replace the church. Mm-hmm. So what the rapture does is it kind of gets rid of Christians where we go off to heaven, and then God begins his restoration of the Jewish people into that leads into the millennium as well, where they reinstate the third temple, yeah. They reinstate sacrifices, and it's really worked out in terms of that theology taking hold, because you've got guys like John MacArthur, really popular, really well known, that will straight up say that there's going to be a third temple rebuilt. There's going to be animal sacrifices get reinstituted. Jesus is going to be here doing those sacrifices as memorials to the old sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's almost like I want to sit John down as, you know, as well-read and smart as he is, and be like, you really think we need to do memorials to the old animal sacrifices with new animal sacrifices, when the greatest sacrifice of all, that when the veil was torn into, Jesus himself was that sacrifice. That's the ultimate memorial. And oh, by the way, we have a memorial called the Lord's Supper that we do, you know, so do we really need this old plan to come back? You know, and I say all this with humility. I was just struck by, well, what if I'm wrong? You know, that still happens to me, because for 38 years of my life, I kind of believed all this stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, I want to say all this in humility, because I believe that MacArthur is a great man of God. I believe that many of these people are great men of God, but I just think that they've been hoodwinked into a 200-year-old scheme. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of what it was, because as you look at what was going on outside of the Christian world with the Rothschild family, all of these books that I'm mentioning, the Coming of Messiah in Glory and Majesty, the Schofield Study Bible, these were all printed at the Oxford Press, it was the London Oxford Press, which was controlled in these years, especially by the Rothschild family. They were approving what could or couldn't be controlled. They had great influence. I didn't know this until recently, on many of the seminary decisions on accepting Schofield in. We can get into that in a few minutes, but I don't know how deep to go into all that, so I'll stop there.
No, that's really, really interesting as far as the Zionism with the rapture, and that it is, it is a reverse replacement theology. And, you know, I mean, that could be a whole conversation in of itself. So let's chat a little bit about Darby. So he takes this idea, this dispensational premillennialism, and runs with it. Right. And so he's like most of the time credited with coming up with this, but as we've seen, goes back to the Jesuit priest. So what is some of Darby's just real quick background, like the dark background of his, because then we'll get into his connection with Schofield.
These are things I did not know, but it links in my mind very much. You mentioned the Khazars and Baal worship and some of the Luciferianism and Satanism. That this is going to sound very conspiratorial, but I believe that the Rothschilds, especially back then, were holding to. And I know that because I've read some of their books, especially the secret ones, like the Hebrew Talisman, which again came out right at that time. And the Hebrew Talisman was a book discovered in the personal effects of Nathan Rothschild. Almost no one knows about it, but it tells the future of what's going to happen with Israel. I mean, looking at where we're at today, And it tells about false theologies being injected into the Christian faith and how ultimately we are going to crush Christianity once we have our nation state in place. And we've got a million Christian workmen working at starvation wages for us in our garden. And I say all that to say this. Darby wrote a translation of the Bible himself. It's not well known, but in that Bible, he uses a lot of Kabbalistic, which is Jewish mysticism, globalist and theosophical language in his own translation of the Bible. So instead of wisdom, he'll talk about intelligence. Instead of the world, the whole world, which was in the KJV, he'll use habitable world, which is really weird, but it's exactly the language of the United Nations. And just to connect the dot, I mentioned theosophical language. Well, the Theosophical Society, they are the spiritual advisors to the United Nations today, right now. Yep. So all this stuff links, and it's hard in an hour, especially when you're talking and trying to remember these things, to link it all. But he made a lot of changes in the Bible, which and omissions. He would omit entire verses, just we don't even know why. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really weird. I'll give one example. This is just one that's right in front of me. 1 Thessalonians 1:9, God is described traditionally as the living and true God. Darby translates it as a living and true God. Well, what does the Kabbalah teach? The Kabbalah teaches that the God of Judaism is one among a round table of gods, and that there's one even over Jehovah. Yeah. Which did you know that, Jenny?
No, I've kind of heard it, but I've never really taken it and looked into it.
Yeah, their ultimate God of all the worlds in Kabbalah and in Talmudic Judaism is, I think it's Ein Sof. It's spelled E-I-N and then the word Sof. I believe that's correct. Wow. That's the God that's over Jehovah. Wow. So when he's writing, Darby, a living and true God, and then he's got this really strong desire to make Jewish people replace the church. And it's like, how's all this happening with the Rothschilds in the 1830s and the books they're printing? So, you know, I haven't perfectly tied it all together, but there's enough there, you know, something's going on.
Yep. Did he have any ties to Freemasonry?
Darby? He didn't. There's no evidence that he personally darkened the doors of a Freemason temple or lodge, but he used them as examples for how to run the church. He said, if we could do it the way Freemasonry is doing it, they've got some things figured out. So he spoke well of it, but he himself said that he didn't know much about Freemasonry. Okay. But when you got a guy translating a Bible, omitting verses, changing things, he could lie, you know, like,
yeah, very true.
But you know, it's hard for me, honestly. And I don't mean to belabor this point. I'll read some of Darby's personal letters to friends, and I'm like, what an amazing, like, committed man of God, even though he was off in some areas. So it can become very confusing because you're judging a man's whole life that he's not around to answer any of the questions or defend himself.
That's but crazy.
It's a mixed bag. And you mentioned some of the darker things. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some occult associations here. So one is his family were the owners of Leap Castle or Lep Castle from 1642 until 1922. It's known as one of the most haunted castles in the world, but specifically in Ireland. And it just looking at the place, I mean, I'm not like what do they call those people? Woo-woo kind of a person, you know, I don't really believe in ghosts haunting things, but this place does look really scary. And here's the thing, like, so it's got all these stories about ghosts haunting it. And when I think, does that really affect Darby? He can't help like his family owning some castle, right?
Yep.
Well, we know that he lived in it for a time. We know that when it was finally, when they gave up ownership of it, the next year, the people that were, you know, looking at it found a room called an oubliette. I believe it's called an oubliette. Yes, an oubliette dungeon, which had a torture room in it. And they call these pony carts, but there were three cartfuls of bones that they had to cart out of there. So that room was in the Bloody Chapel, which is one of the towers in it. You know, if the family owned this thing for multiple hundreds of years, they would have known about that room. Because if you live in your house for 10 years, you're going to know every square inch, every nook and cranny just from cleaning it. Mm-hmm. They knew about this thing and they knew about the bones in it. They had to have. Yeah. The rumors even go that there was a watch that was found in it among the bones that was, and when I say rumors, what I can find is repeated stories, but there's no source to back it up. So I don't know if it's just kind of a copycat thing, but this watch was dated to like 1850. So that would have been when Darby was alive. His brother lived there.
Wow.
His brother lived there, and his the woman he married was an occult writer who held seances in this castle. So that's enough right there. I'm like, his family had occult ties as close as his brother and sister-in-law in the castle that his family owned. And another piece of this is Darby formed a group of exclusives. So Darby was a pretty mean guy when it came down to anybody that would question his authority on things. He would write them off quickly. So because of that, there were a lot of fractures and schisms within the brethren. He formed his own exclusive brethren, which would basically follow everything he said to a letter and didn't question him. Well, one of the families, and you can find letters of the Crowleys writing pamphlets about they were writing Plymouth Brethren literatures and tracts, and they did a lot of them. And I can't think of the father's name, but if you heard the word Crowley, you probably know where I'm going with this.
Oh, yeah.
They had a son that the mom knew something was a little bit off with. She began to call him the Beast. She even called him the Beast 666. Jeez. And I looked up Crowley talking about this. He said he loved it. He loved being called that. He thought it was kind of cool, right?
Wow.
I said, I don't know how. Aleister Crowley is not his original name, but he changed his name to that when he fully took on the mantle of being what he described as the most evil man in the world. But his parents were, they were Darbyites. They were part of the exclusive brethren. So you look, Jesus says, you can judge a tree by its fruit.
Yeah.
Look at the fruit of this. You've got a lot of occultic things. You got an oubliette, which that's not exactly fruit, but it's weird to have that in your home. Yeah. Then you've got the Crowleys coming from it. So really, really strange.
Wow.
That might be all of the dark stuff. If I'm also working on who was funding him at the time, there's some really, really weird stuff there, but I've not got it written down enough to go into that, but that'll be in my next article.
Yeah. So then real quick, let's wrap up his connection to Cyrus Schofield. He takes him in, from my understanding, just little research I've done on this. Right. And that's how it eventually ends up taking over America. Right.
Yeah. I mean, okay. 10,000 foot level. At this moment, the connection between Schofield loved Darby's theology. I don't know that he had that much personal connection with him. There may have been some, but I'm a little bit fuzzy on that. What I do know is Schofield took it on wholeheartedly.
Okay.
Schofield was pretty corrupt. He's not the kind of guy that you'd say, okay, this would be a great minister for my local community or my family. He was a crooked attorney. He didn't support his own kids. He had a couple marriages. It doesn't really feel right.
Yeah.
The big deal here is, okay, how did he come into prominence? He got invited to be a part of the Lotos Club, LOTOS. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm, I have not.
Okay. Mark Twain was a part of it. The Rockefellers were a part of it.
Okay.
A couple of Rothschild agents in America were part of it. It was a highly exclusive club in New York. I don't know if it's still around or not, but it was almost like a high level 33rd degree Freemason kind of a deal. So they weren't directly connected to Freemasonry, but it helps people understand it to say that.
Yep.
Well, how would Schofield get invited to that? He didn't make any money. His way was paid. Wow. They were the ones that gave him these ideas. He then goes to London, walks away with a contract from the Oxford Press to print the Schofield Reference Bible, the Schofield Study Bible that we all know today. He comes back over to America, and he's already got popularity. He's presenting these things to D.L. Moody, who's, again, great man. But you wonder, why did D.L. Moody accept these ideas? D.L. Moody does a lot of it's hard to pin anything negative on him. You look into who funded the Moody in a big way. There was a lot of Rockefeller money in that. I didn't know that until recently. Pastor Rick Wiles brought that to my attention and was able to prove it, that one of his strong funding sources were the Rockefellers. Well, the Rockefellers were part of the Lotos Club.
Yep.
And then it goes back to the, the Rothschilds as well, because they had agents in that same club. So that's when it really spread in America. And I'm sorry, I feel like I'm doing hopscotch history right here.
No, that's okay. I mean, yeah, because I know it went into the Dallas Theological Seminary at that point with the Scofield Reference Bible. So, I mean, that's a lot, like so much information. And
yeah, let me give one more connection point here.
Yeah.
Because when you're looking at, like, this could be coincidence or it's, have you ever looked at, you know who Hal Lindsey is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. So he was one of the big modern day popularizers with his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, which a lot of people that are now like the Tim LaHaye of the world and the Tipping Point guy who does a lot of premillennial dispensationalism stuff, they point back to Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth. Well, Hal Lindsey went to a Jesuit school. A lot of people think that he was secretly a Jesuit. He wore a Star of David necklace all the time, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But even I probably don't need to go into it right now, but Tim LaHaye and others, a lot of the symbolism they use is Jesuit symbolism.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, how could it be? Is it possible there's a Jesuit connection all the way back to Lacunza? So I'm working on that.
Could be. I might have to have you back on after you get that article written. Like I now I'm like, oh, I need to dig in. I wouldn't doubt it because that's how the enemy works. Like, I think, you know, after the digging in that I've done the last couple years, like this is a work of the enemy. I truly believe that. And I've talked about that on some of my podcasts before, but first off, thank you so much for this information. I know that everyone is going to love this. I will link your article in the description of the podcast and also share it too on social media. So if you guys follow The Rooted Truth on it, let's be real, just on Instagram. And so go check that out and read it. A lot of information. And you have, how many Rumble videos do you have kind of just going over this information?
Over this information, only two right now.
Okay.
But there's a lot of videos I have with pastors and other, like the one with you, that definitely more than touch on it. We talk about aspects of this in a lot deeper way. And that's the, thank you for putting my link out there to Substack to the article and the videos, because I have time to actually take something that's 200 years long, really complex, think it through and put it down in a formulaic way. Whereas on a podcast, it's like, okay, which part's important? Because it is very big.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's a long article, but it's worth reading it. And you have two of them out right now. It's going to be a 5-part series. So you guys go check that out. Again, thank you. I would love to have you back on down the road too, as you start to find out more information in your research and, you know, chat some more about this.
Well, likewise, I definitely want to have you guys back on, because I'm still, and this is moment of transparency, I'm still debating, and I've got to do a lot more work on and prayer about this, on whether I'm a believer in postmillennialism truly, or some kind of post-tribulation second coming. But there's going to be this tribulation, and those are two very opposite things. But you know, right now I just have the equation. I just know that the equation I did have was wrong, and I'm rebuilding toward what I now believe is right.
Yep. And I think that's what we do too. When we realize like we had an error in our belief system, we pray about it. The Holy Spirit leads us, and then we just keep digging, and it's a journey with God. And I think it's a fun one. I had the best time the last couple years with with the Holy Spirit of like, okay, yeah, putting pieces together. Just keep praying about it. And, you know, the thing is we have to all remember that end time theology, eschatology should not divide people. It should not divide friendships. And I will say that time and time again, it's okay if I believe one way and you, like, if I'm an all-mill and you're post-mill, we can still be friends and we can still talk about things. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah. So do you want to leave the audience with anything, again, share where they can find you and find your stuff?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, you said what my ending was going to be,
that
ultimately there is something far greater than having the, you know, exact correct interpretation of eschatology, and that is the gospel and our future blessed hope of the return of Christ and being with him. So that's what we need to be sharing and spending the majority of our time on. But I also think the Bible talks about do not be deceived, and that there are wolves that will come among you. So we need to be aware of those things also. As far as where to follow me, you know, follow my Instagram, because I do something on there every day at least. But if you want to dig into this stuff, my Substack, JSLA USA, and my Rumble channel is where I put the, you know, the visual version of it. So check those out, and I would very much appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, you guys. Until next time, be in the Word and be in prayer about this stuff. Like, and dig in too for yourself. So I want you guys to do that. So thank you, Jeremy, and we'll have to have you back again. See you guys.
Thank you, Jenny. I look forward to it.